Welcome to the Advisor Talk podcast channel. This is Nick Stewart, CEO and Authorised Financial Advisor at Stewart Group. If you're new to the show, Stewart Group is a CFEX certified financial planning and advisory firm serving clients throughout New Zealand with offices in Hawke's Bay and Wellington.
The information provided or any opinions expressed in this show are of a general nature only and should not be construed or relied on as a recommendation to invest in a financial product or class of financial products. You should seek financial advice specific to your circumstances from a financial advisor before making any financial decisions. A disclosure statement can be obtained free of charge. My pleasure today to have in the studio Tim Ewens from the Stewart Group right here in Hastings. Tim is an insurance specialist, but before we get there, Tim, welcome.
Hi, Ken. How are you?
Pretty good. I just wanted to tell us a little bit about the Stewart Group before we get into your speciality.
Absolutely. So Stewart Group are your financial stewards. We've been providing financial advice excellence for 37 years. We provide advice on wealth management, risk insurance, KiwiSaver and pension transfers. We're proudly DIMS certified and the founding members of the Global Association of Independent Advisors, Finzo New Zealand Limited and Te Rihi Solar Network. We're also B Corp certified and members of CFEX.
Haven't heard about DIMS before. What is it?
DIMS stands for Discretionary Investment Management Services. When an investor gives you authority to make decisions about buying and selling financial products on their behalf. Now, to provide DIMS under the FMC Act, you must hold a DIMS Market Services Licence. Now, it's issued under the FMC Act.
And ACI, that's a sort of a bit of a spin-off almost of KiwiSaver, isn't it? But you can touch it as you go.
You're right, Ken, 100%. Minimum investment $50.
Yep.
Three different investment options in terms of the risk profile. So, for example, like you and I, where retirement is 40 years away, we could go for a potential high-risk investment, but potential higher returns that fluctuate as you travel down the investment highway. Whereas if you're closer to retirement, a more conservative approach is what's needed. And it's horses for courses. It's depending on where you are in amongst that investment cycle.
Tell us what you do at the Stewart Group.
My title is Risk Insurance Manager. Mm-hmm. So there is myself and Nicole, who is the Client Services Officer, and we look after the risk management side of the business for Stewart Group, which is basically making sure the right money goes to the right people at the right time.
Insurances, you've got to have them, love them or hate them, you've got to have them, I guess. But what are the must-have policies, Tim?
Great question, Ken. One size doesn't fit all. However, there are certain components that are transferable. So, for example, if we've got a husband and wife, a couple of kids, and stereotypically the lady may be at home looking after the kids, they may have some mortgage debt, then life insurance is an important component of their risk management plan. So that if the husband was to predecease the wife, there is a lump sum that goes to the family. They can retire debt. They can cover education costs. They can replace a portion perhaps of the earning capacity of the father that isn't there. Also, the biggest asset that we have as individuals is our ability to earn income.
Mm-hmm.
So if we can ring fence our income to protect it so that if we can't go to work, either through accident or illness, then money will come into the household to cover the mortgage costs, rates, insurance, all those household expenses that accrue and are climbing in the current climate, of course.
Yes. I wonder if this question is how long is a piece of string, I guess. How much should we have? I mean, you know, here I am just saying I'm the breadwinner and I want to look at getting life insurance. And I say, well, I'd like, I don't know, $2 million. Is that an out of the way policy amount? Or how do you work out how much policy a man needs or a woman needs?
I would answer a question with a question, mm-hmm. and I'd say to you, Ken, how will you justify your $2 million of life insurance? What is it going to be used for? Is it going to be used for retiring debt? And you might say, well, look, I've got a commercial property of $1.5 million, so I want to make sure that I retire that debt, and that's freehold for my estate,
yeah.
And then I want $500,000 for final expenses such as funeral and a distribution amongst my children, etc. So there's a justification. So it's about the quantification of the numbers. Now, if we had two couples with the same number of children, identical stages of life, we would not necessarily get the same answer, because some people's view on what is appropriate and adequate cover is different from another's. And it's not for me to necessarily tell them, you should have this figure mm-hmm. as a number. It's me to go through the process, guide them on the risks, the traps, the pitfalls, and a potential outcome if one was to predecease the other. Some people might say, clear the debt, and the other survivor can carry on working. Yep. The other person might say, clear the debt, I don't want her to work for the next 10 years. So we're going to get $1.5 million worth of cover.
I was doing a bit of research prior to you coming in, and some of the must-have policies that I was reading about, where you've got to have house policy, contents, car, health, travel, business. I suppose the list goes on.
Tick, 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 tick.
And where do you draw the line?
Where do you draw the line? The key thing is to understand what the risks are and how do you mitigate them. Do you transfer the risk, which is what insurance does, or do you accept the risk and you self-fund it? So in other words, you might say, right, for my knee operation, I'm not necessarily going to have health insurance. I'll put $100 a month into a pot, and when I need that knee replacement, I'll pay cash for it.
Yep.
That's how some people approach
okay.
the insurance.
So I need to make a claim. I come and see you because you're my broker. What happens?
We sit down and we understand the reason for your claim. And then we obviously go through the process of making that claim on behalf of the client. Now, some claims are quite straightforward. For example, when it comes to health insurance, more often than not, the clients will do it themselves by going to a portal or online access or through an app, because they have the detail that has come from the specialist. It's more than likely emailed to them. So all they do is transfer that detail through to the insurance company, and the claim is then assessed, and more than likely a pre-approval is given, particularly in the health insurance situation. However, when it comes to life insurance, Ken, it's a time of stress, to say the least. People have lost significant people in their life, mm-hmm. and they need someone to go alongside them and go through the process with them and help them complete the right forms, because there may be a bit of toing and froing around the documentation required, death certificates and so forth, and it is an incredibly upsetting and stressful time of life for those people when you think they've just lost a loved one, and it can be quite bewildering, especially if perhaps they don't have children around to assist. Mm,
indeed.
So we're not there just to set up the risk plan and take the premium on behalf of the company. Well, the company takes the premium direct. We are there to be a part of their life when they need support the most, which is at claim time. And for me, as a risk advisor and a risk insurance manager, that's when I get the most satisfaction, is helping people out at claim time.
Yeah.
Especially if people perhaps might come to us, Ken, and they might not even know they need a claim or are able to claim. I had for instance, many moons ago, well, actually it wasn't that far ago, on the golf course, overheard a conversation about Mr. ABC that had had a heart attack. So put a note in my phone for when I was back in the office to give him a call. I said, you need to come and see me. He said, why? I said, I've heard you've had a heart attack. He said, well, I'm fine. Everything's tickety-boo. I said, well, you've got this policy that could potentially pay out. Come and see me. There could be some money. And he's, oh, fine. So he came in, filled out the forms, and within 7 working days, there was X dollars paid into his bank account.
So
when we review with our clients their risk management plan, one of the key questions is, how are you feeling? How's your health been? Have you broken anything? Because some of the more advanced, for example, income protection policies provide lump sum payouts if you've had a broken arm mm-hmm. or a broken leg. For example, if somebody had a broken leg, there could potentially be 2 times the benefit of their income protection insurance, because that's where that benefit is normally attached to. And if somebody, for example, was earning, had a cover amount rather of $5,000 per month, they could get $10,000 paid as tax-free into their bank account rather promptly. All we need is just the medical evidence to complete the form.
Yeah. Tell us about the pros and cons of ACC versus health insurance.
Great question. ACC will pay the adult minimum wage for a 40-hour week if you can't work because of accident. So what this works out to be is $22.70 times 40, which is $908 a week. Now, that comes to, I'm playing with numbers here, Ken, but $47,000 in round figures per annum as a gross income, which is not insignificant. You'll get 80% of that. If you can't work because of an accident, then you pay tax on it, which gives you $617 per week. So going back to health insurance, would that actually cover the cost of having to get an operation? Well, if you need an operation because of an accident, that's a separate issue altogether. Generally speaking, ACC would pay for you to have an operation if it was required to put you back into work.
Yeah.
However, if it was a knock that knocked you out of work for 3 or 4 months and didn't require an operation, that's off the table.
Yeah.
But you would get your loss of earning compensation. If you needed an operation down the track, maybe if you had health insurance, that could come into play then, because it's elective, one might say.
Yes, indeed. Tell us about disclosure. You mentioned a bit earlier on in your conversation there that you know, you say to someone, how are you feeling? I'm feeling great, and I'll come to take out a policy with you. Is it a question that we need to be upfront with disclosure from our point of view, or is it a case of don't ask, don't tell?
It's a case of acting in good faith, both from the insurance company point of view, from Stuart Group's point of view, and also from the client's point of view. So the client has to act in good faith and, to the best of their ability and knowledge, complete an application in, I guess, the heading of acting in good faith. If they knowingly retain information that could be material to the policy being issued and or a claims acceptance, then they haven't acted in good faith, and that could put a claim at risk.
Yeah.
However, people often get a little bit caught up with all of this. So, for example, if, Ken, you fell off your trike when you were 14 and you broke a leg and you overlooked that, and then we completed an application when you were 35 and you had to make a claim for life insurance, perhaps you passed away prematurely at the age of 45, if that isn't going to materially affect the insurance company's either ability to claim or, you know, pay out the claim or acceptance of issuing the policy, then it probably could be irrelevant.
Yeah.
However, if there's material information, you know, kept back by the client, for example, if Tim applied for life insurance and he'd had trouble with his stomach, he'd been to the doctor 6 months ago, and 6 months before that he'd had tests and he didn't disclose that, and then it turned out that he had some form of cancer and passed away, then that would materially affect, A, the insurance company's acceptance of the policy and issuing of it, and or the claim as well.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, people who are self-employed, how do they make sure that if they're sick for any period of time, that they're covered? I mean, I guess you've got to have business insurance.
You do. And that's where business insurance is a good product for self-employed people, especially those starting out. You can lock in a predetermined amount that's realistic relative to your industry, relative to your the work you actually do. And you can't pluck a telephone number out of the air, but it's got to be realistic, and you can lock that figure in. Now, more often than not, when I'm structuring a risk management plan for a self-employed person, I'd say Ken Limited is important, the business. He's employing people. He needs to keep things ticking along. So what we'll do is we'll put a cover on you, Ken, but it's owned by the business. Mm-hmm. So therefore, if Ken can't come to work, either for accident or illness, the money will be paid to the business. It's taxable assessable, so it's like revenue. However, the premiums are fully deductible. And normally we have a short wait period for that, for example, 4 weeks, and we might do it for 12 to 24 months, depending on the industry and so forth. Mm-hmm. Then alongside that, you can ring fence your own personal income protection insurance, as an aside. And also, being self-employed, you could look to lock in your income protection insurance via ACC for accident. So yep. Cover plus extra will do that. And you can pick a number that's applicable to you, mm-hmm. and it can be locked in up to $80,000.
Speaking of owning policies, who owns a life policy? So with my life insurance policy, for instance, I'm embarrassed to say I wouldn't have a clue about it, but do I own the policy and it goes into my estate, or does my policy, when I die, does it go straight to someone else?
I'll go back to what I said at the start of this chat, Ken. The right money to the right people at the right time. Reading underneath that, ownership will determine the flow of funds. Now, policy ownership supersedes estate rules, probate, wills, memorandum of wishes with trusts, anything and everything. Anybody that owns a policy will receive the funds from that policy in the event of claim.
Yeah,
that's how it works. So you and me and anyone else out there has to know that the insurances that we have are owned by the right people. Generally speaking, if it's a husband and wife or a couple, you own them together as joint owners, so that if one predeceases the other, the funds flow through to that survivor. But also it allows that other person to access information. Whereas if just Tim owns his policy and I die, it goes to my estate, mm-hmm. and then my wife has to go through a whole lot of legalese to try and get access to that money. But more importantly, while I'm alive, she can't even access any detail on it.
Yeah, Yes, not a good idea, is it?
No, sir.
Now, in the notes that you sent me, you've got, what terms should we look out for in policy agreements? I mean, I guess when the average person looks at an agreement of anything in this day and age, there's a lot of fine print. How do you whittle out what you need to know and what you don't need to know?
That's where it comes to the key point of using somebody that is experienced in the industry. They can cut through the legalese, mm-hmm. the jargon, the fine print, and go, okay, what will this policy do fundamentally? What is the cover going to do in bright lights? What's underneath it in terms of the low-lying information and benefits, but what fundamentally will it do? Like life insurance is pretty straightforward. You pass away, the money goes to the owner of the policy. Income protection insurance, you can't work, the money goes to you to cover your time while you're unable to be in employment. But what other benefits are in there? So the advisor will tell you, well, hang on a minute, you've got some features and benefits here you may not be aware of. For example, some of the more advanced policies with income protection insurance, not only will they pay you while you can't work, they'll put money to your KiwiSaver. Mm. So if it's a long-term claim, you've got this nest egg building up while you're at home and not able to ever work again, heaven forbid.
If I was unfortunate enough not to have any insurance, could I access my KiwiSaver?
In the event of hardship, there are certain requirements that need to be met, but it can be in the event of hardship, you can apply for your KiwiSaver funds for a hardship claim.
Yeah, so it's almost a backup insurance.
Yes, but let's not look at it like that. Let's look at it more as your retirement fund. And that's where, and you touched on this at the start of this conversation, Ken, ACI funds. So what we have suggested to some people, depending on their circumstances, would be have your KiwiSaver, have that ring fence for your retirement, forget about it, keep the money going in, let it build up, because that is for your retirement. However, if you have certain goals that you wish to achieve and put money aside for it, the ACI funds may be a good option for you to consider, because you can access it after 5 working days and the minimum investment is just $50.
Conrad Timlick, it's been my pleasure to talk with you. Just remind our listeners, we want to come and have a chat about insurance. We come to see you at the Stew Group, obviously, but where are you?
We're located in Karamu Road, 204 Karamu Road in Hastings. And also we have an office in Wellington, level 3, 158 The Terrace, Wellington. And you can give me a call. My direct dial is 06650 4335, or my cell 027 666 3338, and a disclosure statement is available upon request.
Tim, as always, my pleasure. You look after yourself. We'll talk to same time, same place next time.